Poets with Shakespeare's genius dramatize in profound and moving ways. What leads human beings and cities to tragic failures or comic successes? Even among poets and dramatists, however, Shakespeare is unique because he wrote not only tragedies and comedies, a rare feat enough, but also history plays, and at the end of his life, a new genre that we often call romances. Plays that begin as tragedies, but through the intervention of wise friends, the gods, and the protagonist's own growth, end as comedies. In all of his plays, Shakespeare has a profound understanding of what brings the condition of peace and prosperity to individuals and to countries, a condition that necessarily involves the common good in Shakespeare's presentations. Shakespeare consistently shows, from his earliest to his last plays, that the common good is an essential aspect of human flourishing, since we are social beings. "What is the city but the people?" asks the tribune in Coriolanus. And in that same play, Senator Menenius compares the parts of the city to the parts of the human body, trying to teach a tyrannical Coriolanus that we human beings are truly interconnected and that no individual part can be considered an unimportant fragment. We know Shakespeare's preoccupation with the common good because he uses that term and its equivalent, public weal, public welfare, people's good, commonweal, over 60 times throughout his plays, from the first to the last. And with remarkable power, Shakespeare helps us see feelingly what is at stake when you have it and when you don't. The major source of his first four plays, Henry IV, Part 1, 2, and 3, and Richard III, often called his first tetralogy, was Thomas More's own Richard III. And both Shakespeare and Moore immerse us in their first literary works in an England where factious lords of church and state vie with each other for private interests, lead the country to bloody, heartrending civil war. As the pious but inept Henry VI laments in Shakespeare's first play, see the first quote on your handout, "Civil dissension is a viperous worm that gnaws the bowels of the commonwealth." In his earliest play, Shakespeare uses the image of the public body, of the body politic, as did Thomas More also in his earliest literary works. That image is used most vividly and most comically in one of Shakespeare's last plays, in Coriolanus, where a humorous and beloved Roman senator calms a rebellion citizenry in the early days of the ancient Roman Republic. Senator Menenius defends the role of the state as reflecting upon or digesting things rightly for the good of the whole city. He compares the Senate not to the head, as we would expect, but humorously to the stomach. He says, in the quotation, second quotation you have, "The senators of Rome are this goodly belly, and you the rebellious members, for examine their counsels and their cares. Digest things rightly, touching the weal of the common, you shall find no public benefit which you receive, but it proceeds and comes from them to you, and no way from yourselves. What do you think, you the big toe of this assembly?" Menenius, humorous and artful, speaks in a highly effective way as he addresses as good friends his fellow citizens, guiding them to imagine and think about their actual situation in light of the larger body politic and its common well-being. The play ends, however, as a tragedy, because the most powerful leading citizen at the time, Coriolanus, does not acquire self-knowledge, remains blinded by his passions, and looks down on his fellow citizens, calling them fragments because they refuse to see his superior greatness. Yet Coriolanus is the one who brings about his own destruction. After rejecting his city's own common good, traitorously joining Rome's enemy and attacking his own city out of revenge. In Shakespeare's first three plays, from 1589 to 1592, there are 18 direct references to the public good, the people's welfare, the country's benefit, the commonweal, the commonwealth, and their common well-being. Humorously, but also tragically, there is in Shakespeare's second play, Henry VI, Part II, a utopia imagined and advanced in which, just like Moore in his utopia, all things are held in common, there's no money, and all lawyers are eliminated. Hence the famous line, quote, first kill all the lawyers. But it's important to know that the line and the utopian scheme are those of Jack Cade, the hardened criminal and traitor with no concern at all for the common good. And in Moore's utopia, the scheme is that of a character called Hithlodius, whose name means speaker of nonsense, and who argues that the ordinary citizen's work for the common good is foolish and doomed to failure. Shakespeare's early plays show us dark human forces at work against the common good. And witnessing them are powerfully cathartic experiences in which we do come to see feelingly what is at stake when tyrannical appetites and false ideas of human happiness lead to murder, violence, and self-destruction. In this early tetralogy depicting English history, we witness citizens willing to destroy their own fellow countrymen to satisfy personal ambitions and passions. But England is not alone in young Shakespeare's history of dark forces working against the common good. His early depictions of Roman history immerse us in similar heart-rending strife, eliciting the same cathartic experiences, again at the very start of Shakespeare's career. In 1592, for example, he wrote that extraordinary narrative poem as long as some of his plays, The Rape of Lucrece, allowing us to enter the mind of a tyrant governed by appetite and false ideas of the good. But more powerful and more cathartic, we enter the mind of Tarquin's victim, witnessing Lucrece's terror and piteous pleas before the rape, afterwards her extreme mental anguish, her calls for revenge on the tyrant rapist, culminating in her suicide in front of husband, friend, and father, experiencing all the more powerfully her call for revenge and for an end to Tarquin tyranny for the sake of Rome's common good. Lucrece laments, quote, "Why should the private pleasure of someone become the public plague of many more?" The character who fashioned a common good from this personal, family, and political tragedy is the brilliantly cunning Brutus, co-founder of the Roman Republic and the leading citizen who would, from the moment of Lucrece's suicide, orchestrate the end of the tyrannous Tarquin kings. And Shakespeare is explicit about this. The Rape of Lucrece is the most moving example and symbol of the tyrant ruler's rape of Rome. The next year, in 1593, young Shakespeare produced his most horrifyingly brutal and cruel depiction of the depravity that we human beings can inflict upon each other without regard to the common good in his play Titus Andronicus. There we find no brilliantly strategic Junius Brutus, founder of the ancient republic. Instead, we end with the most cruel revenge motif known in world literature, the horrifyingly inhumanity of a revenger who murders and serves children as food to those children's parent before the revenger murders the hated enemy. Here we have a lawless savagery, a society at war with itself. Where is the Christian view of charity, justice, and forgiveness in these early plays? In those first English histories, Joan of Arc is represented as a witch. Cardinals and archbishops are among the worst Machiavellians. And the pious Henry VI His inability to rule is attributed in the play to his pietistic naivete. In the other early plays, like Richard III and Titus Andronicus, Shakespeare seems to resent an even darker view. In this context, the early 1590s version of The Book of Sir Thomas More comes as a surprise. It's a collaborative play in the handwriting, we have the manuscript, of five London playwrights, including Shakespeare. In that play, More is presented throughout, not just in Shakespeare's hand, although his two scenes show this the best, as a wise statesman who brings about first his city's and then his country's common good. Towards the middle of the play, Lord Surrey is speaking to Erasmus before Erasmus meets More for the first time. Surrey, himself a learned poet, says of More, and this is the third quote on your handout, "This little isle holds not a truer friend unto the arts." And the play, by the way, makes clear that these are the arts of liberty, the liberal arts. "He's great in study. That's the statist's grace that gains more reverence than the outward place. Now shall you view the honorablest scholar, the most religious politician, and the worthiest counselor that tends our state. That study is the general watch of England. In it, the prince's safety and the peace that shines upon our commonwealth are forged by loyal industry." As already indicated, Shakespeare, especially in his last dramas, has wise counselors able to study and effect what is for the common good. Plays such an essential role that Shakespeare creates that new dramatic form of the romance, all of which, besides ending as comedies, show distinctively Christian virtues and concerns at work, especially charity and forgiveness, that give the protagonist the inner freedom to seek the real common good of a country. This early 1590s play, Sir Thomas More, is a mystery and a marvel. The only version we have is a prompt book written out in the hand of Anthony Munday, a strongly anti-Catholic playwright and spy who brought a number of Catholics to their death. And yet this early version of the play is completely complementary to the condemned traitor, Thomas More, although it never gives reasons for More's arrest and execution. Instead, the play gives a series of humorous events by More, each one connected to establishing justice and the common good, enacting the, quote, marriage of wit and wisdom, which is not only the title of the play within the play, but the central and controlling theme developed throughout the play. Not surprisingly, this play never got past Queen Elizabeth's censor, although that censor, Edmund Tilney, wrote marginal instructions that, if followed, gave hope that the play might be performed. So in the early 1600s, either in the last years of Queen Elizabeth's life, when fears of civil war had arisen again because there was no plans for succession to the throne, or in the early years of James' reign when new hopes were abroad, five playwrights wrote additions to the play Sir Thomas More, responding to Tilney's instructions. Two of these additions are in Shakespeare's hand. More's only soliloquy in the play, at the beginning of Act III, right after he becomes Lord Chancellor, there he reflects on the dangers of pride and the importance of enacting laws for the common good. The second addition comes right after Act II, where More is shown to be the only leader the rioting Londoners will listen to. And with his brilliant wit and wisdom, More calms the rioters and brings peace to the city. As the blunt and brave London rioter Doll Williams says, More uses words, not weapons, to bring about the common good. Let's take a few minutes to look at this scene. You can follow on the second page, the second side of your handout. Before More begins, We learn that the rioting Londoners will hear more because of his proven service and goodwill for them. After wittily getting their attention, he makes three distinct appeals to their imaginations. The first and the third help these Londoners to see their mountainous inhumanity, line 157, to their fellow human beings. The middle appeal succeeds in getting them to see the importance of obeying God by obeying the laws and lawful authority. Look at the overall structure of this speech. It's a dialogue with the crowd. Throughout, Moore is sensitive to their thoughts and emotions and intended goods. Before line 83, he has listened to their complaints, and on line 83, he grants for the moment their solution to the complaint. These Londoners have suffered grave, scandalous injustices by privileged ambassadors and merchants from other countries. Because the law has protected criminal actions against them, a band of London citizens decide to defend their wives and their own property by burning the foreigners' homes and driving them from England. On line 83, Moore grants this solution. But then on line 85, he has them imagine the consequences for the long-term common good. On line 91, he asks them to think through the consequences. What had you got? In lines 99 to 100, two of the leaders see the truth and gravity of sharking like ravenous fishes on their fellow human beings. Then on line 102, Moore asks that he be allowed to, quote, set before their thoughts, good friends, the ethical character of their action. They see and admit the gravity clearly in lines 110 to 111. And then Moore goes on to explain the importance of honoring what he calls in line 137, the majesty of law. On line 139, Shakespeare begins the third and last appeal, again as a hypothetical they can imagine and that he invites them to reflect on. What if the king were to punish them as rebels of the law and banish them as they would now banish the stranger? Follow along with me from line 142. Whither would you go? What country, by the nature of your error, should give you harbor? Go you to France or Flanders, to any German province, Spain or Portugal, nay, anywhere that not adheres to England? Why, you must be strangers. Would you be pleased to find a nation of such barbarous temper that, breaking out in hideous violence, would not afford you an abode on earth? Whet their detested knives against your throats? Spurn you like dogs? And act as if that God owed not, nor made not you, nor that the elements were not all appropriate to your comforts, but chartered against unto them? What would you think to be thus used? This is the stranger's case, and this your monstrous inhumanity. So convincingly has Moore entered the minds of these fellow Londoners that they not only agree, but they articulate his main point, the golden rule, at line 158. Let's do as we may be done by. And they ask that he, as a friend, rule them. Notice how this scene shows feelingly that compassion for our fellow human beings, based on a recognition of our common humanity, is a necessary condition for considering the common good, as is respect for law and for authority based on God and his ordained order. These necessary conditions to achieve the common good, seen here, are present throughout Shakespeare's corpus, although in dramatically and intellectually probing, engaging, and creative ways. In the late Shakespeare, the topic of the common good is treated with remarkable subtlety and depth. For example, one major motif is the education of the future leader. In the plays of the early 1600s, Shakespeare's young protagonists are inexperienced but ambitious to do good. Cloistered Isabella in Measure for Measure, the mathematician Cassio in Othello, in King Lear, naive Edgar, forced to disguise himself wittily as poor Tom of Bedlam, untried Malcolm, the future king in Macbeth. All witness and experience the tragic failure of elder rulers in countries they will soon have to lead. All grow extraordinarily in self-knowledge and in appreciation for the difficulties of ruling for justice and the common good. All are suffused with strikingly Christian vocabularies that remind us of the transcendent measures for Shakespeare's own understanding of justice and the common good. This same motif, the education of future leaders, marks Shakespeare's three great romances at the end of his career, Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest. The young, inexperienced future leaders in each of these plays witness their parents' mistakes and potentially tragic ways. All these plays begin as tragedies, but then all have wise counselors who help move the protagonist to a comic resolution, aided explicitly by God's providence and by heroic acts of forgiveness. Instead of the destructive revenge seen in Shakespeare's tragedies and early histories. Given our brief time, let's consider Shakespeare's depth and subtlety in treating the common good in what is probably the least known, but in some ways most deeply Christian of Shakespeare's romances, Cymbeline. The play that involves the greatest jump in time in all 38 of Shakespeare's plays, bringing us from ancient Rome and ancient Britain, both of which are close to nature and the gods, to Renaissance Rome with an Italian Machiavelli, who uses his fiendishly cunning ways against the naive and all too good British protagonists, Posthumus and Imogen. This fascinating play is set at the time of Christ's birth in a primitive England where the earliest kings were kings under law, we're told. In a primitive pagan England that has been strengthened by Roman laws and discipline and guided by a Jupiter who appears on stage, paraphrases St. Paul, and insists in speech and writing, he leaves a scripture, a tablet, that he works for England's peace and prosperity, not only within England, but by establishing harmony between England and Rome. After writing plays for over 25 years, showing England and other countries in war and bitter strife, at the end of his career, Shakespeare devises this astonishing utopia that ends in peace and the promise of plenty for all of England. In this mystifying romance, Jupiter intervenes in history so that Britain, quote, will flourish in peace and plenty. And Jupiter appears on stage, comes in on an eagle, to explain in person his actions, leaving a written scripture to confirm his plans. This play is often judged to be hopelessly improbable and artistically deficient in such things as the 1500-year jump in time and the only dramatic deus ex machina scene in Shakespeare's Corpus. Through the guise of this utopian romance, however, Shakespeare is able to reveal a culture-changing plan aimed at achieving not only a Pax Anglia, but a Pax Europa, one that depends upon the rise of a new type of hero and heroine, educated, married, and re-educated under Jupiter's careful direction. That re-education is ordered to the acquisition of a set of virtues which could give rise to a new approach to government, one based on merit and equity, not hereditary passing on of power, one that aims at the common good for all. Cymbeline establishes a bridge between ancient Britain and both ancient and Renaissance Rome, and it indicates three times that the eagle of Jupiter moves from Rome to Britain by the agency of Jupiter's refashioned Aeneas, that is, Posthumus, married to faithful Imogen. In this play, Jupiter's eagle moves from a spongy, soft, Machiavellian Rome to a courageous, disciplined, law-abiding, and pious England. Only after the new epic couple had been tested and educated to new levels of virtue, especially humility, fidelity, equity, and wisdom. At a climactic moment in Act Three, wife Imogen compares husband Posthumus to a false Aeneas for not only deserting her, but ordering her murder. Posthumus, however, reforms and is shown to have overcome what were Aeneas's tragic defects, shown most clearly and dramatically at the ending. The Aeneid ends with Aeneas killing his enemy in revenge, his eyes rolling in fury, just as Dido's eyes had done as she killed herself, calling down revenge upon Aeneas. Cymbeline ends with Posthumus forgiving his Machiavell enemy, Giacomo, an act that inspires King Cymbeline to turn from war to peace and the common good. In contrast to Virgil's hero, who faces a most unhappy political marriage and centuries of unending wars of glory, the hero and heroine, whom Jupiter educates in Cymbeline, are marked in the end by deepened fidelity in marriage, generosity in forgiveness, disinterest in personal, political, and military glory, and a rededication to a common good that looks beyond nationalistic borders for the sake of peace and prosperity of all. To finish, and to give a sense of Shakespeare's lifelong preoccupation with what we now call the common good and what he called the common good, I've given you a sampling of quotations from his corpus. Look now especially at number 6 on the first side of the handout. Number 6 suggests that the common good requires someone like that heroic Chief Justice in Henry IV, Part 2, who is, quote, busy for the Commonwealth at the risk of his own life, even if it means jailing the future Henry V. Or look at number 8, that suggests that the common good also requires discerning citizens like Williams in Henry V, who can see through arguments of ambitious archbishops and kings, who can publicly debate of Commonwealth affairs and claim their cause is good while actually working directly against justice and the common good. At the beginning of these remarks, we looked at Shakespeare's thought-provoking catharsis induced by the horrors depicted in his tragedies and histories. If time permitted, we would also look at the laughter-producing humor of his comedies, as well as the power and splendor of his virtuous heroes and heroines, able to move us to consider the nobility and necessity of striving for the common good. Throughout his plays, Shakespeare shows there can be no public good without the power and splendor of personal virtues. In the comedies, we have many other examples of, quote, the watchful statist, fully alive with the wit and strength and resourcefulness of a Rosalind and her father, Duke Signor, in As You Like It, both of whom, for example, show the melancholy loving Jacques and us that even the ungoverned passions for self-pity and sadness are means to, quote, betray ourselves and disable all benefits of our common good. So deeply insightful Shakespeare is about the absolute necessity of virtuous people to have a public good. In the tragedies, for instance, the tragedy of King Lear, Edgar's heroic care for his father moves even his criminal brother to repent and to want to do good before he dies. In the romances, Imogen's and Posthumus's virtues move even the Machiavel Giacomo to reconsider and repent. And there are many other examples. There's the splendor of Hermione in The Winter's Tale, who, although she collapses mentally and physically after her husband's grave injustices towards her and her children, at the end she forgives him. And throughout her trial, she mirrors the grandeur and poise and language of Catherine of Aragon, the heroine of Shakespeare's last play, The History of Henry VIII, which brings the histories up to Shakespeare's own lifetime. And this is Shakespeare's true farewell to the stage. In that play, Cardinal Wolsey is condemned for, quote, not respecting the common good. And although Catherine believes Wolsey is the one most responsible for destroying her own marriage, she forgives him, and then she's crowned by angels. Then, of course, we have the witty and strong and resourceful Thomas More, whom five London playwrights agreed should be praised when their country desperately needed someone who would tend the common good with study and loyal industry. In his last play, Henry VIII, Shakespeare has Wolsey, fallen and disgraced, praise Thomas More as his successor as Lord Chancellor, expressing the hope that More, quote, number nine, would do justice for truth's sake and his conscience, predicting that if More did, he would, quote, sleep in blessings and have a tomb of orphans' tears wept on him, alluding to the Lord Chancellor's special duty to care for the most needy members of society, such as orphans. Wolsey then delivers one of Shakespeare's finest speeches, one Abraham Lincoln knew by heart and would recite by heart. It's an elegant, impassioned speech warning his young protege, Thomas Cromwell, against the dangers of pride. Wolsey advises him in quote number 10, lamenting just before his death, "Be just and fear not. Let all the ends thou aimest at be thy countries, thy gods, and truths. Then, if thou fallest, O Cromwell, thou fallest a blessed martyr. My integrity to heaven is all I dare now call mine own. O Cromwell, Cromwell, had I but served my God with half the zeal I served my king, he would not in mine age have left me naked to mine enemies." As Shakespeare reveals throughout his plays, striving for the common good requires considerable wit and wisdom and exceptional courage to do justice for truth's sake and conscience. Thank you. They are works of Shakespeare, and they are good. I have to admit, Titus Andronicus is my least favorite of all of Shakespeare's plays. It is the most heartrending, but it's meant to be. He is imitating Seneca's revenge tragedies. It's Seneca's art form to show Rome how corrupt they are and how much they have to change. Shakespeare does something similar to his fellow citizens who are killing each other. I should also say his Henry VI plays were box office hits. He has three parts. He had three sequels to Henry VI Part One. And Richard III is still probably the play most performed worldwide. It is so powerful, his Richard III, and it's his fourth play.
Thank you, Professor, for your fine presentation. I have a question for you. Most of these examples that you read to us and discussed with us from Shakespeare and in the life of Thomas More have to do with the virtue of statesmen, the virtue of kings, the virtue of chancellors. What does Shakespeare teach us about the importance of the virtue of the citizens, especially he doesn't speak very much of republics, but that's a relevant topic for us, I would think, since we purport to be, or aspire to be a republic.
Again, Shakespeare is writing for a culture and a time that he knows intimately, and I think this is why it's so important we think about an example like this for our own time. We have to find ways of doing what Shakespeare did in his time for our time. He lived in a time of virtual absolute monarchy. It's very dangerous to write against the monarchy. There are lots of forces in Parliament and in society that are gradually building up the strength of Parliament and citizen virtue. But this is the interest of Shakespeare's sequence of Roman plays. Coriolanus has a very strong, virtuous citizenry. Menenius is an admirable senator. He loves the people, and he works for their good. More is not a member of the royalty, Thomas More. And in his earliest and latest plays, he draws upon Moore's own example in finding a way to speak to the culture that exists, but look to what the culture aspires to, and then help cultivate those virtues. The comedies have much more to say about, I think, private citizen virtue, and you have magnificent, magnificent characters, like Rosalind, one of my favorite, and As You Like It. Yes, Cassius and Brutus, who murder the tyrant. They deliberately will not bring in Cicero to the plan. Cicero, who writes in a way that gives an alternative. And we find out in Julius Caesar that both Brutus and Cassius are moved in the final push by personal passion and personal interest rather than by common good. It's a fascinating play, especially on the virtue of friendship. Brutus manipulates Cassius to do his will. Cassius feels inferior to Brutus because Brutus does everything in the name of virtue. Brutus is willing to take bribes and money that Cassius takes, but he won't do it himself. Shakespeare's knowledge of human nature is why we still read him today, and the depth of his character development. Cicero could well have come up with an alternate solution, which he gives in his book On Duties. But Brutus and Cassius want to do it their way. I think, for instance, one of the major themes you see in Shakespeare is what Cicero calls the leading citizen, someone who is an important figure in the culture, in the city, dramatized, understands the weaknesses and strengths, and can move it forward. I think this is why it's such an important motif of a young leader seeing the failures of her elders, to prepare themselves to do something better, to learn from them. And I see this as a major contribution. Shakespeare knows Cicero extremely well. It would have been one of his primary texts in school.
I was hoping you could help me understand what you would say Shakespeare's conception or the scope, you would say, of the common good is. It seems to me that he doesn't have in mind just one or another group, given in the position of Catholics under Elizabeth, but that even considering that, given the war and the persecution, he still has in mind the common good of England as a whole.
Shakespeare generally presents it as within the realm of law. In those first four plays that Shakespeare writes as a youth, law is referred to 55 times. In the late plays, law is also given a very important prominence. It expresses the highest aspirations that the society has achieved. But that's also informed with a Christian view in Shakespeare. Charity, grace, are present in Shakespeare's vocabulary even when it doesn't fit chronologically. So it's both, and this is his brilliance, he's able to reproduce Roman culture true to Roman ideals. He's capable of reproducing Greek culture true to Greek ideals. But his major project is to dramatize English culture and suggest through imagery and through plots what its greatest ideals are. But always getting people to engage feelingly in what is at stake. Look at the consequences. Look at the heroism or look at the criminality of inhumane or humane action. It's that broad and yet that specific. And I think that's the importance that Shakespeare always gives to the law.
Great, thank you very much for your talk. I'm wondering if you would think Shakespeare would think there was a similar sort of transitioning that happened after his time, similar to what you talked about, how kind of the transition from Rome to England as a center of political leadership and thought. If you think Shakespeare would see a similar transition happening from England to America, and in what ways that might be true, what ways that might be false. And also I'm wondering, off of that, if you could share some more of your thoughts about what it might look like to do what Shakespeare did in his day here in our day.
Shakespeare was one of the most important educational texts in early America. The productions of Shakespeare were many, many. Tocqueville talks about going to a farm and finding a book of Shakespeare, among the few books that they have. Shakespeare is immensely important for understanding the American love of Shakespeare and how much Shakespeare's questions from the first to the last play, the wisdom of hereditary monarchy. He shows its fatal flaw. That's his first four plays. Henry VI is a saintly person, but he's also a person that's temporarily insane at different times, and he doesn't have the virtues, which he himself recognizes, to be the king. But he's the descendant of someone who is the son of someone who usurped the throne and caused civil war, and that person usurped the throne from someone else who caused the civil war. And so Shakespeare and Moore are both thinking early in their life, what do we do in a culture that's always at civil war? The War of the Roses is over when Thomas Moore is 8 years old. He remembers it from his parents talking about it in hushed, horrified terms. Shakespeare's reflecting on the same thing. They're afraid of another civil war when Elizabeth dies. The whole country is very concerned about this. When you dramatize the problem, you present the problem for what it is, you get people to think about, well, what are the real long-term solutions? What should we do? Something similar. Those who have dramatic possibilities are presenting these problems for what they are. And the people who have rhetorical ability, in newspapers and others, have to bring to light what the real alternatives are, and to know the culture well enough to move it forward. We have enough we agree on that we can do much better.
Professor, may I ask a question? In the last talk, we heard about the relationship between the common good and this idea of public order. Seems to me, I'm no Shakespeare scholar, but this theme of order is also very important in Shakespeare, and disorder, what happens when you allow disorder. And this is connected in a way to being ordered under God somehow. Could you comment on that, the common good and the idea of order coming from God or disorder being introduced in Shakespeare?
Shakespeare is often called the poet of nature, also called the poet of love, and the two go together. The nature of human beings is to love. And Shakespeare has some of the greatest love poetry in his works. But love is all-encompassing and very difficult. And nature is complex and requires a great deal of reflection and education. Shakespeare is hard to read. That's why he's so good. He's an education in political, social, personal wisdom. We can see in characters much better sometimes our own prejudices and disordered motives by looking at someone else and seeing the consequences. Shakespeare is one of the greatest poets of all time, is one of the greatest teachers of all time. And just as Homer is the educator of the Greek-speaking people, writing for a culture in love with war and showing the glory instead of the well-run household of the peaceful city in ways that is compelling, and also the horrors of war, destroying your own best friends inadvertently, he opens the window to something much better. Shakespeare's got the same project.
There's been some controversy about Richard III, whether Shakespeare accurately presented the history as reality versus propaganda.
Right.
I'm not a Shakespeare scholar by any means, but I've read about it and I'd be interested in your comments.
Shakespeare's major source is Thomas More's Richard III. Thomas More started Richard III after law school. After law school, Thomas More spent 3 years mastering Greek. He then challenged Erasmus to a Greek translating contest. They did translations of Lucian, the comic dialogue writer. And More tells us why he chose that author to translate. He said, no one probes more deeply and instructs more fruitfully without destroying the equanimity of the reader. That's a very wise rhetorical principle. If you want to get a hearing, don't anger your audience. Engage them artfully, humorously, if you can, get them to think. After More mastered Greek, he did it so he could read Plato in the original and Aristotle and the Greek fathers. He spent the next 14 years working on Richard III and on Utopia. He never publishes Richard III, ever. He writes it in two languages, English and Latin, and they're two different stories. But while he's writing it, he's comparing it to Thucydides, to Sallust, and the other Roman playwrights. And he's asking himself, what's distinct about English culture and history? And what's common in terms of tyranny and injustice and problems of rule by law? And he comes up with this brilliant work, Richard III. And it's meant to be a work of literature and that is like Plutarch, who's another major source. So yes, Moore's Richard III makes up speeches like Plutarch that we wouldn't know about. But he's convinced, and he tells us in the history that some of these things you can't know because Richard, if he was a dissembler, would dissemble really well. And he also tells different versions of the same thing by different people. This is a masterful work. It's a masterpiece. And Shakespeare knew this early in his career. And he bases his first four plays on it, reflecting on the same human tendencies, weaknesses, propensities that always exist. So it's not our kind of history, but you can say that about every single one of Shakespeare's histories. He uses his materials for artistic ends that are meant to be true to the philosophic and human nature aspects and generally the history, but not the particulars. Now, was Richard III a tyrant or not? My reading of the history is, yes, he was a tyrant. Did he do all the things that both Shakespeare and Moore did? Absolutely not. But it's, being a hunchback, well, actually they just exhumed the body and they found out that he was. Sorry, that's a long answer to a good question, and we could talk about that later.
I think we're going to have to end this session. By the way, Richard III was buried in a Dominican church. So the Dominicans were claiming maybe they should try to get the body back. So let's give our thanks to Dr. Wagner for doing this.